So right now it looks like we have phi psi, and this guy looks like it depends on our little delta phi, right, for our scalar field. So it looks like we still have three things that we need to relate. So the first thing that we're going to do today is look at a simplified case of this to see that actually we can reduce this to just two variables, one on this side and one on this side. And then it's going to be simpler to figure out what's the sort of one good degree of freedom that we want to actually work with to talk about the scalar fluctuations. Okay, so to do that, we need to, so the information that we haven't used, obviously, are the actual Einstein equations. So let's work out a little bit more detail about what's going on this side, and then we'll be able to reduce things. Yeah.
Are you working
in a particular gauge? So far, I haven't said anything about working in a particular gauge, but the point is that neither one of these guys is actually invariant under this transformation. So I'd either better define everything as things that are invariant, or I'd better choose a gauge. So, yeah. Okay. So let's actually write down a few things about delta t. And so today, since the goal is to get to sort of the end of the story, I'm going to leave a lot of the derivations, I think, for the tutorial, some of the fill-in-the-blank parts, okay? But just ask me if you don't see the sort of the trend of where I'm going. So basically, what we need is, so what can we say? About the other side. Delta t mu nu. Well, we know that delta t mu nu is not invariant. And we know, furthermore, exactly how it's going to transform, because all of the tensors are going to transform in essentially the same way. We worked out explicitly what it was for the metric yesterday. So the only thing that I'm doing differently today is I'm actually going to use one index lower and one index higher, just because that sort of simplifies how I have to keep track of factors of A if it's conformal time and things like that. But you can use exactly the same type of transformation rule that we used yesterday, just making sure that you take care to get the indices in the right place. Okay? And then what you'd find is that, for example, if you work out what happens to, let's say, delta t 0, 0 in the new coordinates, that's delta t 0, 0 in the old coordinates, and you can almost guess what's going to happen. There's going to be something that depends on the background value. So by little 0 here, I mean the background value of t00. So this is stuff that depends only on, effectively, if we're using our scalar field, phi 0 and phi 0 dot. Okay. So let's put over here that we're, for the scalar field, we're going to say that phi of x and t is a background value that depends only on time. That's our clock for inflation. And then a fluctuation, delta phi of x and t. So the background stress energy tensor is just going to be a function of those background fields. And there is a derivative here with respect to conformal time. And there is a c0. Okay. So basically, we can get relations that in some ways kind of mirror or mimic the relationships that we had over here for components of the metric. Okay. And then you can see that we have the same problem that we had before, which is that we're going to have essentially several components of t00, and these scalar components are, again, just going to depend on the scalar components c0 and zeta. And so, in fact, we can make combinations now of the t00s and the metric components that eliminate these coordinate transformations, right, that are invariant under these coordinate transformations. So here we need to get rid of c0. And if we go back over here, let's see, we can see that E prime and B combined together transform in such a way that just gives us C0. So we can use this to use those relationships to write delta T00 bar now, which is going to be essentially the same type of variable as these variables are, which is invariant. And this is going to be the combination of delta T00, which transforms like this. And then, since the piece that we want to cancel off is proportional to T00 background, we're still going to have that guy left over. And now we just want a combination that transforms oppositely to this, basically. And that's just the combination B minus E prime. Sorry, prime just on the E, of course. Okay? So that's a combination that is invariant under the transformation. And I'll just write them down. So you have them. You can similarly work out. They're going to be off-diagonal terms. And they're going to be the spatial components. And this one, so they all have the same form where they go like the normal piece that's transforming. And then you subtract off some quantity that's going to sort of cancel that transformation. So in this case, it's T00 background. And there's minus a combination that's basically the trace of the spatial part. So these are spatial indices k to the 1/3. And again, this combination, b minus e prime, but now there's a derivative with respect to I. Yeah.
So the background of T0, how is that related to T bar?
So T bar is a definition for the perturbation.
T-bar, you also define T bar
this
time.
Sorry, no, T bar is just the background, so there are no fluctuations there, so I don't need to worry about how it transforms.
So what is the zero T?
So the zero here just means background. So I guess what you're asking is, what I'm defining is...
How would that define?
Okay, sorry, sure. So T mu nu is going to be a background T mu nu plus delta T mu nu.
Yeah. Last time you called the zero T mu nu T bar.
Ah, did I?
Yes.
Oh, okay, thanks. Oh, okay, sorry, I forgot about that. Okay, so yeah. So I guess let me know. I guess that was a bad choice because I forgot that I wanted to find these quantities as bar. So let's call it zero instead. I'm sorry. Yeah, thanks. Okay. And this one, I guess let me keep I down just for consistency, is again delta T I j. There's a zero T I j. That guy has a prime, and again, b minus e prime. So we didn't quite get there last time because we only wrote the metric components that were invariant. But you can see that you can use these in a similar procedure to also write this side as something that's invariant. You can make combinations delta g mu nu that are invariant under coordinate transformations. Sorry, these are upside down, you're saying. Thanks. Similarly, you can work out the same types of quantities for the combination of the metric pieces, the curvature pieces that appear here. And then we're kind of in business, because then we can write the delta g ij bar, the Planck to the minus 2 delta t ij bar. And then whatever set of coordinates we use, whatever gauge we use, we can use this relationship to always help us change coordinates in a way that's completely consistent. Okay? Yeah. Yeah.
The first line in that board is how delta t changes. But for us to be able to work that out, we have to use not only that but also the zeroth order Einstein's equation.
So in order to work this guy out, the only thing you need to do is work out the transformation for a general tensor, particularly for t mu nu, with this prescription for xi here. But then what you say is, okay, that guy is clearly not invariant under the transformation. But we can figure out a combination. Since we know we're in the end, we want to relate the metric fluctuations and t mu nu. And since both of those things change under coordinate transformation, we can make a combination using b and e that doesn't transform. I guess looking at this implies this. Okay, any more questions?
I guess I'm just a little confused about the knowledge that you're using in the first line is how the first order variation of a tensor changes under a coordinate transformation.
Right? Yeah.
And is there like a standard formula for that?
Yeah, so basically we had it on the board yesterday when we did g mu nu, right? Depended on how we changed dx by dx tilde, dx by dx tilde. And the only thing here is I've just raised one index, so you have to make sure you get the indices in the right. Yeah, good. Okay, so this is just a lot more useful, basically. Okay, so now what you can do is you can look now at the Einstein equations, and any result that you get, basically, using this complete gauge invariant thing, or transformation invariant thing, is going to be a result that holds for all coordinates. Okay, so one very useful, so there's useful information. It's going to simplify our life in the IJ Einstein equation. And so again, you know, you'd have to go through and work out this whole thing, and I'm going to give you the piece of the answer that's important. And the piece of the answer that's important is that that equation goes like a whole bunch of stuff, where stuff just means there are h's, there are phi's, there are psi's. But the important thing here is that it comes with a delta I j. Let me try to be consistent. Okay? There's a piece that only comes as delta I j, so it's a diagonal piece. And then there's a piece that is not just limited to the diagonal. And that part is 1/2 capital phi minus capital psi, ij. And that equals, of course, M Planck's squared ti. Sorry. Ij. Yeah.
So is that just the ij component that you're looking at?
That's right.
The first line up there.
This line?
Yeah. Is it mu mu?
That's me, sorry. Brain is already going to the next step, which I want the IJ one. Yeah, everybody, this is true for everybody, sorry. The one that we're going to use right here is the IJ one. So the point of this is that regardless of what sits here, if you have the property that this thing is diagonal, right, this is delta, if this thing is diagonal, then essentially this piece has to vanish. Okay? And that's extremely useful because we had these two variables, right? But if this has to vanish, those two variables have to be the same, and then we're going to be reduced to 1 degree of freedom. So, of course, the reason I'm writing this is that it turns out to be true during inflation. And so during inflation, all this is going to simplify. So for the scalar field, basically delta T ij will be proportional to delta ij and phi will be equal to psi. So in a minute we're going to work out some components of what the stress energy tensor perturbation is for phi, and you can see that it's true. But let me just make a comment that this is a property of perfect fluids, so it's a property of many fluids. You have a question? That's derivative with respect to I. Sorry, these are upside down too. Wow, sorry guys, somehow upside down all over the place. Okay. All right, same thing. Yeah, so this is a derivative here, and these are derivatives here. Okay, so you remember yesterday we wrote down the stress energy tensor for a perfect fluid. And we had T mu was rho plus P. There were these four velocity terms here, mu mu, mu nu. And then we had a piece that was the pressure times G mu nu. And you remember the important thing about these guys is that they were the velocity in the reference frame of the fluid. So for example, if we were just using normal cosmological time, we had written down that u mu, which is dx mu d tau, was 1, 0, 0, 0. If we'd been using conformal time, which is what we've been using to do all of this, let me write it down so that you have it, then we just would have had an A here. Okay? But the point is, you can see that when we're in the background that's FRW, which is what the scalar field source is, this guy's diagonal, this thing only has components in the 0, 0 part. So the only IJ stuff is essentially coming here. And the typical field is diagonal. So that's not always the case for generic fluids. Sorry, so let me just put what that is for a scalar field, for example, ends up being just rho p, p, p. I think the signs are right. Let's see, I guess this is going to be, yeah, signs should be. If it's lowercase, I guess there's a minus sign there. If this is t, you need it lower. Right, because, no, it's still plus, sorry. It's only if it's one up, one down, it's minus. Okay. More generally, though, this is diagonal. More generally, though, fluids can have another piece which is added here. And what people write is just so there's a piece which is P, let me write this as delta mu nu, plus the rest of it, let me write it as sigma mu nu. So see, if I had raised one index here, this just would have been a delta mu nu, right? So essentially, maybe that's confusing. It's going to go like a P delta mu nu. Plus rho plus P, right? So if I write it here, it's clear that it's actually diagonal, which is what we wanted here. Okay, so basically this part is still going to be the diagonal piece, and this thing is going to be a traceless matrix, which is the rest of it. So this is only the off-diagonal terms. And those off-diagonal terms are basically the things that are breaking isotropy, right? They're choosing either a preferred direction or they're transferring momentum between directions. So this is the anisotropic stress. So what you often hear people say is, in the absence of anisotropic stress, blah, 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 these two things are actually equal. But the point is you know, it's really that anisotropic stress is a word for a property of the stress energy tensor which makes it have off-diagonal terms in the spatial part. Okay. Yeah, so here I...
But you're saying that it's diagonal.
Yeah, I've cheated a little bit and said let me just take out the diagonal part and leave this sigma mu nu. So more properly I should probably define it with one up, one down, and then this would be sigma ij, this would be delta ij.
Right, or
yeah.
Eta.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, good. So basically then, we found out that we had phi equal to psi from one of the Einstein equations. So from ij Einstein equation. So now we've used a property of the source, right? We've used a property of the scalar field to simplify our solution. The property of the solution was that the stress energy tensor is going to be diagonal. And so that Einstein equation told us that we have phi equals psi. So that means now that we haven't used all the information, right? We have more information in the Einstein equations. And that information is going to relate for us the one metric degree of freedom that's left to delta phi, the one degree of freedom perturbing our scalar field. Okay, and since those things are related, right, there's another equation that tells you how one is related to the other, there's really just one scalar degree of freedom that we have to worry about. Okay, so you probably can't read down there.
We haven't yet said V equals to E, right? So
we haven't yet done what?
We haven't yet said V equals to E equals to zero. Or
yeah, we haven't done any of that. That's right, because this I could write in a completely gauge invariant way. Yeah, yeah.
So this relates, basically reduces the 2 degree of freedom that you're going to have to 1 degree of freedom.
Exactly.
And that can only happen for scalar fields, that's what you said.
Well, it can only happen for things, whether for diagonal T, right, which tends to be just the case for scalar fields. So here. So what we've learned basically is that there's one scalar degree of freedom to worry about, and it's some combination of the scalar field perturbation and one scalar metric perturbation. And so you can imagine, given this freedom that we've been talking about to change coordinates, that there can be lots and lots and lots of ways, lots of gauge choices, lots of coordinate choices that I can make that are going to give me a particular form of this answer. So what we're going to want is a good, if you like, a good variable. And you can imagine that part of the definition of good is going to be to try to find some combination of those guys that's invariant combination. But the other part of the definition of good is that we have this phenomena that we solve for the fluctuations inside the horizon, some oscillating mode, it freezes out outside the horizon, and we need to track the evolution of that thing through the end of inflation back to where it re-enters to get predictions for physics after inflation. Yeah?
So this phi is the scalar field.
Yeah, this phi is the scalar field. Yeah. So from now on, I'm only going to use this capital psi. Yeah, in fact, let me write that here. Metric perturbation, let me use capital psi. Because now we're only going to have psi and this phi, and we won't have any more of this confusion about variables. Yeah, sorry. Yeah, we can choose here, but let's just use that one. So one part of what's good is something that's invariant, and the other part of what's good is something that's well-behaved outside the horizon. And in fact, well-behaved here actually means there's actually one that for a single degree of freedom is actually constant outside the horizon. And the reason that's important is that we don't have to know then, and we don't have to figure out what happens to this mode, you know, as we don't have to know the so modes that we see in the CMB exited inflation early. We think a bunch of more inflation happened, but we don't know precisely what it looked like because we don't have observation sensitive to that. Then there was some transition, there was reheating, the universe started to evolve, radiation domination, matter domination, and at some point those modes came back inside the horizon. But the point is, if the amplitude is what we say frozen, if it's really constant outside, we don't have to know all of that detailed physics about what happened. We can say we calculated it when it exited inflation. Whatever else happened, even though I can't observe it all, I can't figure it all out, I know what the amplitude of that mode is when it re-enters the horizon, and then I can do normal cosmology to track that mode afterwards. So this is an extremely useful feature. Without this feature, we'd have a really hard time doing much of anything. Okay? So this is what we're after. And then what we'll have to do, or what people often do, is choose. So, but in practice, of course, you know, just like once we've defined these guys, it's easy to work, say, in Newtonian gauge, drop this part and just talk about phi and psi. We can always go back and figure out what the full phi and the full psi is. It's easiest to choose some gauge and then take that answer and plug it in to the gauge invariant combination that you write down. Okay, so same thing as here. Here we could have just looked at phi and looked at psi. Go back here and we know, or looked at B and looked at E, go back here and we know what the full combination is. So in fact, what's going to happen is that, let me just write it here. So one of the good combinations, there are a couple that differ by small factors. One of the good combinations is this variable zeta. And zeta is basically defined as the combination of psi And let's get the sign right. So in reality, this is coming from a combination of psi and a combination of the energy density perturbation. So you could take the generic stress energy tensor in terms of, you know, rho, p, and u, and you could work out in terms of that. But when you write it, when you substitute it in for the scalar field, this just becomes h over phi dot background times delta phi. Okay. So what's going to happen is that you can either choose a gauge, for example. So this is coming from basically delta rho over rho background dot times h. But I've substituted already in for delta phi. What's going to happen is you could, for example, choose a gauge where there is only scalar field fluctuation. Right? We have 1 degree of freedom, so we can choose a gauge such that only delta phi is the fluctuation that we follow. And then zeta is literally equal to minus h dot delta phi. Or we could choose a gauge where we're looking at constant density slices, right? So delta phi is zero, and we can just calculate this perturbation. But no matter what we do, we know how to map it into this zeta. Okay? And you can already see that in some ways this is going to be a really easy choice, because you already know the answer for what happens to this guy. And it's also an easy choice because actually inside the horizon, this is what we'll show in a minute, when you're inside the horizon, basically up to horizon crossing, if you look at this combination, this one is actually small in a sense. So if you look at the full Einstein equation, which is what we'll do, actually a conservation equation, this is small. And so up to horizon crossing, the answer, the fluctuation, the two-point function is the answer that you already know, which is basically h over 2k cubed times this guy, which is going to give us an h over root epsilon. Okay, but that's what we're going to go through. Okay, so this is sort of the answer, but one approach, which is this practical approach, is we're going to make a choice, which is that we're going to use Newtonian gauge. And all we need is basically one more equation, right, to relate our Newtonian gauge fluctuation to delta phi. We need one more equation. And it turns out it's easy to use one of the conservation equations. Conservation equation tells us that t mu nu, covariant derivative with respect to mu, is equal to 0. And you can just use the mu equals 0 component. Okay, so basically what we're going to find is something that, because we're using Newtonian gauge, it's going to relate the psi and the phi in some sense. But we're going to see exactly this trick that inside the horizon, this part doesn't contribute much, and if I look then at the full gauge invariant combination for what turns out to be zeta, it's going to be a really simple solution in terms of delta phi. All right, so you know the general form of this equation, right, for t mu nu. So you know that, so I'm going to write it for the full thing. We're going to just look at the perturbations, but let me show you the general form of the equation first. So that's a covariant derivative, right? But the first term is just essentially a normal derivative. So I can write this as d mu nu dx mu. And then I'm going to have two terms that have Christoffel symbols in them, right? One up, one down, so one plus, one minus. These are going to be gammas. And they're going to be some t's, right, with the appropriate indices. So basically, I can put the mu here, alpha mu here. I need to contract here. Alpha nu. Mu mu nu alpha alpha. Okay. And that was the lower index, so now I want to instead, sorry, that was leaving the lower index as it was, so now instead I want to replace the lower index for nu. Alpha mu mu nu. And it's that thing that's equal to zero. Okay. So we're also going to start right away using Fourier modes for the spatial part. So that these derivatives basically are going to bring down factors of k in whatever direction. What else do I need to tell you? So I told you we're going to use Newtonian gauge. The other thing I'm going to do, so we want to look at the relationship between delta phi and the metric perturbations. Now, in general, if I look at t mu nu and I perturb it, I'm going to have both delta metrics in there and delta phis in there, right? Because the definition of t mu nu, depending on how I raise and lower, has some metric perturbations in there. So I want to make it clear which part contains delta phi and which part contains the metric. So I'm actually going to write, I'm going to define delta t mu nu hat as only the part containing delta phi. So basically no metric. No psi. So that it's going to be really clear which part is the metric part and which part is the delta phi. Okay? And again, because this is a long computation, I'm going to show you the answer and then we're going to look at what it means. So you can work this out. It's long. See if it's going to fit here. No, probably not.
Yeah,
that's right.
It's a derivative, so there is metric there all the time. So
I guess what I'm saying is if we wrote out t mu nu, I would have terms, so I have terms, let's see. So for the scalar field, let's make sure I can see if I can get this right. We have, basically d mu phi, e nu phi. And then there's a term that has a delta mu nu, but inside of here there's a g alpha beta d alpha phi d beta phi minus the potential. Is that right? I think that's right. So yeah, so you can see that if I started asking for delta t, here I'm going to have delta phi, that's fine. Here I'm going to have v prime delta phi, that's fine. But I can never avoid having some metric fluctuations sitting in here. I would have some deltas. At first order, I have some delta times phi 0. Background derivative, and then delta phi times background metric. Yeah, thanks. So what I'm doing is I'm just moving these pieces that would have delta metrics in them, so they have psi's. I'm moving them out because what I want to have is something where it's clear which is delta phi and which is metric.
So you mean no metric?
Yeah, so no metric, no psi's are sitting inside of here.
No delta of the metric is sitting inside.
No delta of the metric is sitting inside. And I know it looks like a strange thing to do, but it's gonna make it a little clearer which is delta phi and which is
okay.
Okay, so what's the answer? Well, I'm gonna put everything with delta phi's on one side, which is these t mu nu's, and everything with psi on the other side. So basically I've got d by dt of delta t hat 0, 0. So you can see that these terms are basically derivatives with respect to the 0 component or the spatial components here. But now I've taken the spatial component and I've used the Fourier expansion, so I'm going to have an I and a k. multiplying delta t hat 0i. A t 0, 0 part, and a pure t ii part. And this whole thing is equal to rho plus p d psi dt.
So you have switched from using...
Let me not do that, huh?
Conformal time to cosmological time.
So I think the only... I know there's one here, too. Yeah, sorry, if you want, we can restart it, right? So you can just switch back if you want. It's not gonna matter. But these are the only two I think that are occurring, so you can switch them. Sorry. Okay. So now basically what we need are these things for the scalar field. Right, because it's coming from the derivative bringing down the ik. It was ik dot x.
Right.
So it's ik. And these are contracted indices. I guess it would be better to use j or something with it. Sorry.
Yeah. So everything else in this equation is real except that.
That's right. That's right. So we have, yeah. I guess we haven't worked out exactly what this component is, so it's not. But, yeah.
So I'm a little confused. The t hat, those are not the Fourier coefficients, right?
So the delta t hat are what we would have gotten by expanding this, but we've also written phi. Instead of phi of x, as phi as a sum over Fourier modes. So the delta t's are now sum over Fourier modes for phi, delta phi. So in fact, we're going to find that because of that, delta t 0 j also has an I in it. So.
Okay.
We're going to find that term is real. Okay. Okay, so to find these guys, basically you just need to evaluate this. And again, I think given the time, I'm just going to write down for you what they are. But you know, you can just basically the only thing you need to do is expand phi, and you're going to remove or ignore essentially any terms that have delta g here to plug in what you need. And you're not going to be surprised probably what they look like, right? Because we know what t 0 0 is for the scalar field. It's the we had it right here a minute ago, but it was the energy, so it's going to be the kinetic energy plus the potential energy. But now this is just going to be the kinetic energy and the potential energy to first order in the fluctuations. Okay? So instead of a 1/2 phi dot squared, essentially, we're going to have to first order one term that's sitting on the background and one term that's a fluctuation. And then we're going to have, instead of the potential, we're going to have the derivative of the potential with respect to the field evaluated on the background times delta phi. And similarly, the ij term isn't too surprising because, again, instead of being the energy density, it's the pressure, which instead of being the sum of those is the difference of those. So it's going to be, yeah.
In that last line, we need delta t hat 0, 0, comma, what is that?
Sorry, et cetera. You know, we need all the components. Oh, yeah, sorry. For the scalar field.
So the comma is not the...
Yeah. Okay, so this guy also is not surprising. So it was, before this was minus the energy density, rho plus, sorry, which was kinetic energy and potential energy. Now we're going to have essentially rho, we're going to have the pressure, which is the difference of these. And so we effectively just change the sign on this guy, subtract the same thing.
So maybe only me, but I'm a little confused about what is Fourier mode, which things are Fourier modes and which are written in real space.
Yeah, okay, so let's basically, all the spatial parts, everything is a Fourier mode, but we Fourier transform the spatial parts only, right? So
right.
Just like we did before with the scalar field. So if you like, you can go through here and these are all, this is now a mode equation.
Okay.
Yeah, maybe that makes it more clear.
Yeah,
makes it. So here, I guess it's kind of hard to notate where it sits.
Sure.
Here, in this equation, it's kind of hard to notate what it is, except that you see this k appearing here instead of a derivative,
whenever
so that's the tip off.
I have to put a k, there's a k implied, I guess.
Anything here that's a function of the perturbations has a k. So the only one that's maybe surprising, so we already said that there are no, sorry, so this in fact has a delta ij, right? Sorry. Because we already said that delta and the i's and j's are all over the place. The delta ij. And you can plug in and see that that's true. There are no off-diagonal terms here. There's just the diagonal, and the diagonal are just the pressure term, essentially the perturbation of the pressure term. So the only term that's surprising, then, are the terms that mix the spatial and the zero component. So I guess I was calling that zero j over there. And that term, you can see it has an extra derivative of the scalar field. So let's see if we can see that easily. So basically, it's coming from a mixed term here. One of these is spatial and one of these is time. So the only way that can be is if the background is only a function of time. So to first order in perturbations, the time index has to be a derivative of the background. So there's going to be a phi zero dot. And there's going to be a spatial derivative of a delta phi. And that spatial derivative of a delta phi is what's going to give us again an ik. Okay, does that sort of make sense? Basically the terms I'm looking for are coming from here. First order in the perturbations. The spatial derivative in the mixed term has to act on the perturbation because the time term has to act on the background. So the result is just vectors of A minus I case of I delta phi. That's that derivative on delta phi. And then there's the background piece, which is phi zero dot the time derivative on phi zero. Okay. So now we're going to do. This is a lot of terms, right? If I plug in all that, it's actually a big mess. Although we're going to see that it simplifies. But the first thing that we can do is just look order of magnitude. What's the left-hand side? What's the right-hand side? Okay? So order of magnitude. For the left-hand side. There are a bunch of terms, right? But all of the terms actually have a similar form. So basically, for example, the first term, we need to figure out what to do with the time derivative. Order of magnitude, if we're asking, you know, what's the time scale in the problem? The time scale in the problem is Hubble, right? So we can always take d by dt and basically say that this is a factor of h. So I'm going to give us order of magnitude estimate. So we can see, for example, that we've got h we've got delta t hat 0, 0. That has two terms, one that's a phi dot and one that's a v prime. So let's just say there's a phi dot there, right? Times delta phi. Remember, did we write down the solution for phi dot in the slow roll case? Do you remember the equation of motion, right? We had, we had phi double dot 3h phi dot was equal to minus v prime of phi. And remember, in slow roll, we disregarded that term, right? So you can see that, so again, yeah, sorry. So here I've got, let me write out the whole thing so I don't. So here I've got this term. But this we already said that derivatives go like h. So here I've got h cubed, h squared times delta phi. Then I've got phi zero dot. But v prime, right, is also just h phi zero dot, essentially. So I could have replaced v prime in the slow roll limit with h phi zero dot, order of magnitude. So both of these terms go like h phi zero dot delta phi. Okay. The next order term, again, you can see what I've got is k's, which are going to, I've got a k squared phi dot delta phi, right? K squared a squared over a squared delta phi phi zero dot. So this term is going to be bigger or less than this term depending on how close the mode is to horizon crossing, right? So at horizon crossing, this is also the same order, h squared delta phi phi zero dot. And for modes that are inside, it's actually much, much bigger, right? K is much bigger for modes that are inside the horizon. Those are short wavelength modes, so K is large. It's actually much bigger. And it's bigger by a factor of K squared over A squared. So it's much bigger than H squared delta phi by zero dot. Okay, so you can keep checking the next terms. The 3H delta T 0, 0, that's almost identical, right, to the first term we wrote down, because the time derivative got replaced by an h, so the third term there is the same as the first term. And the last term there is the same as the first term, right? The last term is h. If you plug in delta ii, then that's, again, phi zero dot delta phi dot. Okay, so all the terms are the same order, this quantity, except the term that depends on k squared. And that one, of course, depends on whether you're well inside the horizon or outside the horizon. Okay? Okay. What's the right-hand side? What do I need? Let me try to put it here. Well, to get the right-hand side, actually, we could have looked at the 0, 0 Einstein equation. And the 0, 0 Einstein equation, remember, in the background case was pretty simple. Equals rho. And remember, this was coming from terms that had, So you had A dots over A is coming from essentially both the terms in R and R mu nu contracted with G mu nu. You had some combination from each. If you go back and write the same thing in terms of the perturbation, what you find is that you see k squared, and again, this is a Newtonian gauge, k squared psi plus 3ah psi prime plus ah psi is equal to minus 1/2. And of course, it has to depend on delta t 0, 0. But delta T00, we know what it is, right? It's just the perturbation to rho plus rho plus P. Sorry, to kinetic energy plus potential energy. So again, you can rearrange this. Order of magnitude to solve for psi, right? Again, if I take a, sorry, this is h, let me put it as h times a dot here so that it's consistent with what we've been doing so far. These two terms are of the same order if the time derivative, sorry, a times psi. So I changed the derivative with respect to conformal time to cosmological time so that it was the same notation we've been using here. Then you can see, again, time derivative is like h. These two terms are the same order of magnitude. And then there's one that's k squared that's essentially different by an a squared h squared, k squared over a squared h squared. Okay. So I can write that psi is basically equal to, if I divide over by the stuff that's on the other side, right, which is a h squared, there's already an m Planck squared here. It's equal to that up to the fact if this term dominates, and then there's a factor of a squared h squared over k squared. Okay, so I'm being a little bit loose here. I had already delta t over m Planck squared. I canceled the a squareds everywhere. I divided through by the h squared, right? So I said everywhere order of magnitude there's an h squared. And then depending on whether I'm well inside the horizon or not, either this term dominates if k is large, or this term dominates. So either this thing is 1, or it's actually this small factor. Okay. So what we find is that for k much, much less than a squared h squared, psi is of order this thing, or smaller, right? Psi is, in fact, much, much less than delta t0. Sorry, you probably can't see that, can you? Let me see. Right. So where are we at? So basically, inside the horizon, we've got psi much, much less than delta t 0, 0 over h squared and Planck squared. But what is that? Well, we know what that is over there, right? It's a perturbation to the energy. And basically, it's easier to write if I use a relationship for phi dot in terms of epsilon, right? So we know already that phi zero dot is small compared to the background energy, right? We said during inflation things are potential energy dominated, so kinetic energy is small. So basically, since it's proportional to this phi dot, right, you can see where we're kind of going. It's kind of like energy, right? Because V on the background is h squared and Planck squared, kind of like energy, but it's smaller by a factor of epsilon because it's a phi dot there. Okay. So essentially what this is if you like, delta T00, the background energy, times the factor rho plus P over, I don't know why I'm writing it like that. Let me just write it as phi dot squared. Dot squared over h squared. And Planck squared. Sorry. Trying to write it in a way that's simple and I'm confusing everybody. Okay. Basically what I said is this is essentially the energy times epsilon. So this is something that goes like zero dot delta phi h squared and Planck squared. This is something like, it's actually root epsilon h and Planck delta phi h squared and Planck squared. So I think basically it's something like epsilon. Yeah, some of my units. So this is units of h. My convention isn't quite working out here. Phi dot, is this. Somebody see where I lost my dimensions? Let's see. So this is 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 2, 3, 4. So this has the right dimensions. Sorry, of course, it's because it's delta phi dot. So there's another h here. So this thing is basically of order h squared. So this is like root epsilon h over m Planck. Okay. So what I did here is, yeah.
Sorry, on the left-hand board in the bottom right, are those k much less than a squared, h squared, or k much greater than?
Much greater than, thanks. Well, inside the horizon, right? Okay, so here I'm estimating you for the order of magnitude, but essentially what you can see is that it's a perturbed energy over the background energy, so it's going to be something small, okay? Epsilon h over m Planck. But the reason we're doing that is essentially to compare it to this quantity here, because on the right, when we were looking at, we want to compare the left-hand side to the right-hand side, so we want to compare this side, h squared delta phi, phi background dot, to that side. And the equation, the full equation, had a d psi dt on the other side, right? So did I erase the full equation? I did. Yeah, I just did. That was fine. Okay. So basically what we were comparing was this side to d psi dt times, let me put back what we had on the right-hand side. It was d psi dt, and there must have been some factors of h squareds. There was a 3 rho plus p. All right, so this is basically energy density, which is like psi dt. Instead of rho plus p, I can put 3h squared, m Planck squared. And if I use what this is for psi, then this is something like root epsilon h over m Planck, so I'm going to have something like h cubed. M Planck. And this is essentially, again, this is factors of, yeah, I could have actually just left the delta phi and the delta phi dot, but this is factors of h cubed M Planck root epsilon. So it's roughly the same order of magnitude of that, but we said because of this extra factor of k squared over a squared, it's much bigger. Do you guys want me to write that out? Basically, this side is getting a boost from k squared over a squared, and this side is getting decreased in some sense by the inverse of that. So the upshot is that inside the horizon, this side of the equation is much bigger than the other side of the equation. So inside the horizon, we can effectively just drop that term over there. And if we do that, since I'm completely running out of time, inside the horizon we can ignore psi, then our equation simplified. It was an equation for the delta t is equal to 0, basically. So let me write it back up so we have it again. Zero. So if you actually plug in what all of these things are and you reduce it, this actually is just the equation of motion for the modes phi sub k. Okay? Believe it or not. This thing reduces to delta phi dot dot minus 3h delta phi dot plus k squared over a squared. Delta phi equals 0, which is just our normal equation of motion for phi, and these are all the Fourier modes. Okay. Okay. So basically, what we did is we've used. Let's recap a minute what we did. We've used two new equations. We've used a conservation equation, and we've used the other Einstein equation, the 0-0 Einstein equation. We used the 0-0 Einstein equation essentially just to confirm for ourselves that we could simplify the equation, essentially what's the equation of motion for phi, inside the horizon. Inside the horizon, we found that that simplified equation of motion is just the equation that we had before. So as long as we're inside the horizon, we can solve for this. It suggests that the power spectrum at horizon crossing is the same power spectrum that you found all along, right? So this suggests that at horizon crossing, P for phi is basically just h squared over 2k cubed, the same thing you were finding all along. And then if we say we ask what that means for zeta, remember we had this zeta, which was minus psi minus h phi 0 dot delta phi. So we played a game where up to horizon crossing, this guy is pretty much negligible. So if we want to ask what p zeta is, p zeta is going to be h squared proportional to phi 0 dot squared h squared over 2k cubed. And substituting in what phi 0 dot squared is, so this is something that you probably have in your notes from the slow roll solution to the equation of motion, we get this, which tells us that the power spectrum goes like h to the 4. So I'm missing, to make this dimensionless, I'm missing two powers of Planck, 2k cubed. And the difference now is that there's a factor of epsilon. So the dimensionless thing, right, we're going to have the k integral, which gets rid of this. We're going to fix the dimensions of m Planck, is h squared m Planck squared epsilon. Okay. So. In some sense, this was a little bit of a mess, right? Because we had the Einstein equation, the perturbed Einstein equation, and we had to figure out which variables didn't transform and how to relate those variables, and then we had to choose a gauge, and in that gauge, things were simpler, but then we really want this variable, and what happens outside the horizon. So it's still a little bit complicated. There's a much, much, much easier way to do this, which maybe gives you less physical intuition, but which is much more straightforward, and that's what we're going to do next time, which is based on the ADM formalism. So going through all of these exercises of what's the magnitude of things gives you some physical intuition about what's going on and why it's a hard problem. But it's also very confusing because it's hard to choose a very clear path to the answer, you know, in any one way because you have to sort of know the answer in order to get the answer in the fewest steps. And as you can see, it's still a lot of steps. So what we're going to do next time is look at how, if you use the ADM formalism, where instead of starting with the Einstein equation, you start directly with the action. And instead of the Einstein equations, you have constrained equations. This whole procedure is much, much simpler. And it gets us to the same route a lot faster. Okay?